Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Now, first, before we start the show, I want to extend a special invitation to all of our listeners. Join us for a live interview with Hunter Walker and Loopy B. Lupin, the authors of The Truth, Progressive Centrist and the Future of the Democratic Party. This insightful discussion is scheduled for Wednesday, January the 31st at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, which is 4:30 p.m. London Time. Don't miss this opportunity to hear directly from the authors about their perspectives on the Democratic Party's future. To get the Zoom link, simply go to royfield.com and click on sign up to join our newsletter. It's an event you won't want to miss. Also next week, we'll be doing a show with Professor Rami K. Kahouri of the American University in Beirut, where we will be discussing the future of Palestine. Both of these shows you will have a link for if you join our newsletter, and both will be posted on our YouTube channel. So please go there and subscribe. So it's Mid-Atlantic Podcast on YouTube. We need your support. We received an interesting email from Don Barry last week, a listener with a keen ear for regional expressions regarding last week's panel podcast. Don writes, "You were 100% right about brass monkey weather. I was born and brought up in Manchester and I'm very familiar with the expression. So it's not a Midlands thing. Your Mid-Atlantic contributors know nothing." So there you go, Corey. Don gives it to you in the neck. Don, thank you for setting the record straight and for your input on the colourful tapestry of local colloquialisms. Before we get started, I'd like to give a shout out to Liz Astrom, who requested this week's topic of Canadian politics. Remember, if there's a subject you're eager for us to cover, just email me at royfield.com. We love hearing from our listeners and bringing your ideas to the forefront. Without any further ado, here is today's discussion.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
The United Kingdom is a great country.
Never, never been a good bet to bet against America.
Hi, hello and welcome. This is Mid-Atlantic. I'm Royfield Brown. I'm your host and I am in Birmingham in England. And today, it's been quite mild, 12 degrees centigrade. First off, before we start, Adam, Sean, How chilly was it today in British Columbia?
It is warm today. We had a cold snap that was below, it was minus 40, minus 43. Last week, but it's above zero. I think it's 2 degrees Celsius right now.
Not warm, Adam's not warm.
it's very warm for late January. And we're looking at 10 degrees Celsius on Monday.
Laura, you're just by Lake Ontario, aren't you, if you're in Hamilton? All right, I'm bracing myself. How cold was it today in Hamilton?
You know what? We're coming out of a cold snap too. We were seeing about minus 10, 12, which to me is not that cold, having lived in Winnipeg. But right now, actually, we've been driving through a cloud for the last 3 days. It's been just one gray cloud on the city, total fog. It's that lake effect, what happens. And we're sitting at about 3 degrees, which is almost shorts weather. We went to the gym in our shorts.
Yeah. I can categorically tell the pair of you that 3 degrees Celsius is not shorts weather. Please. Yeah. Come on. It's not. But let us move on from the weather in Canada, east and west, and let's talk about Canadian politics. So you've heard their voices. We have two renowned Canadian pundits with us today. From the East, we have Laura Babcock from the O Show in Hamilton. And she has somewhat of a keen eye when it comes to the political dynamics north and south of the border. And from the west of Canada, we have Adam
Short,
who is a good friend of mine from Clubhouse, somewhat of a seasoned and grizzled. Can I call you slightly a contrarian, Adam?
Contrarian and recovering political operative.
There you go, from British Columbia. And he's going to help us to understand the policies and strategies of the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the challenges which he's going to have to face in 2024 with the ascent of the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre.
There is no good news for the Liberals anywhere in this latest polling from Ipsos, provided exclusively to Global News. The country is tired of Justin Trudeau, and were an election to be held today, Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives would almost certainly win a majority. When the Liberals vaulted from third to first in the 2015 election, it was all because of Justin Trudeau, a leader that Canadians were excited about after nearly 9 years of Stephen Harper. 72% of respondents said Trudeau should step down now. Even among those who are Liberal supporters, 33% think Trudeau should go.
I've never seen a number that high for a prime minister, probably since Brian Mulroney back in 91, 92. And that's what this really reminds me of.
And because the Liberal brand is now so closely identified with Trudeau, Trudeau's falling popularity has pulled the party down. If an election were held today, 40% would vote Conservative, 24% would vote Liberal, 21% would vote NDP. Among Quebec respondents, 32% picked the Bloc Québécois, 28% would pick the Liberals, and 22% would choose the Conservatives.
Question to you, Laura. Public opinion on the election. Nearly 46% of Canadians surveyed by Nassos said that they want a federal election to occur this year. Is this because everyone is just so tired of Justin Trudeau? His approval ratings are somewhat in the floor. Why are people wanting a new election?
Because Canada has been going through a really deep affordability and housing crisis like nothing else that we've ever seen. And in spite of the fact that we're doing pretty well vis-a-vis other G7 nations, Royfield, we are completely not feeling it on the ground. Our grocery prices have been crazy. Inflation's been crazy. Here in Hamilton, which is one of our largest cities, my family helps out with a food line that feeds 800 people hot meals. It looks like something from the Depression era. People cannot get housing. There's a lack of housing stock. The government did not plan for the housing needs that would come. There's a lot of housing stock, as my colleague would know, out from the West Coast that's been bought as investment, right? And that's not being available for Canadians. So Trudeau has just announced a war effort on housing, which many of us have been calling for. It might be too little too late. They've tried to get the big grocers into price affordability. Also might be a little too late if you ever go to a grocery store in Canada and you hear the people on the line complaining about Trudeau. So I think that they got hubris, like any government does after several mandates. And they might have done well during the pandemic, but they lost touch of those kitchen table policies that a lot of Canadians are feeling. Now, a couple of ripples in that, though. They also, and I look forward to hearing what the former political dark arts operative has to say. My business is, of course, public relations. One of the things that Trudeau did, which I think could be a fatal mistake, was to not define Pierre Poilievre, to not fight on the social channels like Poilievre has been doing for 2 years. And Poilievre has used rhetoric and a lot of the kind of MAGA type devices we've seen out of the Trump, campaign in the U.S. It's like doing a campaign Trump ran in 2016, a lot of the same rhetoric, a lot of the same stuff, but really good social media stuff. And you watch Trudeau and the Liberals got caught without having a robust reaction to it, or even more importantly, proactively pushing their own policies. So they ceded the ground to this guy. And so now what's happening right now in Canada is two things that are quite earth-shattering, I think, for the country and for this conversation. And they're all in the last 48 hours. One is that Trudeau, there was a ruling from a lower court that just came down saying that Trudeau went too far in using the Emergencies Act to stop the convoy occupation in Ottawa and what was happening in the border blockades. And it's interesting to me because when I posted, you know, that I respected the judge's ruling, we'll look forward to see what's on the appeal. I thought at the time the Emergencies Act was warranted. But a judge who wrote a ruling basically saying they might have done it too at the time. And there weren't a lot of options because Premier Ford didn't do his thing and the Ottawa police effectively weren't doing their job either. It looked as though that was the only option for Trudeau, but in judicial review, it was too far in terms of the Charter of Rights and Civil Liberties. So there's going to be appeal on that. But what's really interesting to me is the backlash to that ruling that I have seen. People are furious about it. And it's bringing out this anger at the convoy, which Polyev is now, you know, completely joined at the hip with. So it just might be the energizing factor for the tired Liberal base, because I've seen more love for Trudeau and the Liberals in the last 24 hours than I've seen in a very long time. And the hatred for Trudeau is baked in the cake already with the Conservatives. So this might actually give them some weird wins in their sails. The other thing is there was just a shooting, a domestic terror attack on the City Hall in Edmonton, which is north, west in the country. And the shooter's manifesto, he wasn't able to, thank God, hit anybody. He was taken down by a security guard. But he came in with semi-automatic rifles and Molotov cocktails. And the manifesto that was posted and now removed echoed much of the language of the Polyev rhetoric. So I mean, obviously, you can't blame Polyev for what this person did or tried to do. But it's eerily similar around wokeism and other things. So those are pretty big things that might change the landscape a little bit in this country.
Let's look at how this man, Pierre Polyev, has risen and how he's transformed himself. So he is the relatively new conservative leader, came in last year, and he's now seen as somewhat sharp and competent and a potential prime minister. But he used to be the party's attack dog. Adam, tell us about his rise and his transformation.
Yeah, Pierre Polyev has a rise is a good point. He has been a member of parliament for going on 2 decades now. He's a young man in his 40s, became a member of parliament, I believe, in his late 20s in the Harper era, and was a cabinet minister for Stephen Harper, including the housing minister. But he is known as an attack dog, one who is willing to go fight in the House of Commons and use some pretty aggressive rhetoric to defend the Harper government and to criticize the Trudeau government. He is the third leader of the Conservative Party since Stephen Harper stepped down in 2015 and Justin Trudeau was first elected. He was elected last year. He won a meaningful majority of support in the leadership contest in 2022 and is probably the first leader since Stephen Harper to have a unified mandate. His approval rating has improved somewhat. He does have a significant disapproval rating as well, in particular with women. But both the fortunes of his personal popularity and especially the popularity of the Conservative Party has risen substantially since he became leader, and are now consistently in double-digit leads in polling, which is a likely majority government territory for the Conservatives if the election were to be held today or tomorrow. And Laura was saying the Liberals have done little to try to characterize him in a negative light or to control the narrative at all about who he is. And basically, he's been given an open pathway since becoming leader to define himself. The Conservatives have substantially... go ahead.
Just on that, kind of on this narrative, because I read a few articles which people are trying to compare him to Trump, and many people saying that this is exaggerated. But the Liberals have tried to at least push public perception in that way, that he is some level of a right-wing radical. That would be fair, wouldn't it?
That the Liberals are pushing to label him that way, or that he is that way?
Saying that he is. That's for you to say.
I think of late, very lately, the Liberals have woken up to the fact that they need to try to get control of the narrative of who he is and try to define it. And they have seemed to opted for this kind of MAGA North identity. You heard it in the Prime Minister's speech today to his caucus, the caucus retreat in Montreal. And it's associated with, he was identifying candidates who represent conservative positions on abortion and other things. But yeah, certainly like the court ruling, the federal court ruling on the protests will put Polyev in a somewhat difficult position, whether he wants to be closely aligned in defending those protests or not, because it could give the Liberals ammunition to help define him as a Trump candidate. I don't think that this idea has really settled in with a lot of Canadians. I think for those that don't like Polyev to begin with, it's an easy way to not like him, to give an excuse not to like him. But I'm not getting the sense that the perception is that people see him as just another Trump. We have the People's Party of Canada, which is an upstart political party that is, I think, fits the bill. And I think there's enough space between the People's Party of Canada and the Conservative Party of Canada for Polyev to say, no, I am not this.
He was with the protesters, with the convoy, right? So he's already been identified and associated with that group and the occupation in Ottawa. So I don't think there's sunlight between the convoy and Polyev. But to the point, is he Trump light? I said yesterday, he is not another Trump. He is a lifer, career politician who's cynically using the Trump train of this obnoxious populism and picking up on the pandemic angst and the economic angst. And it matters tremendously in Canada who wins the election in the U.S. in November. Tremendously. If we see some sort of an uprising, a civil war, whatever the chaos, there's 10 different scenarios we can all map out for the U.S., that's going to have Canadians looking very closely at what kind of leadership we need in Canada to counteract that or to work with that, right? We're, I think, tied at the hip with what's happening in the U.S. And that's why I personally follow it so closely, because we have a party, at least with Polyev, he is copying some of the rhetoric from not now, not the crazy stuff Trump's saying around big camps and mass immigration, taking immigrants out in mass swaths and all this Hitler stuff he's saying. Polyev's not saying that kind of stuff, but he is doing more of this DeSantis attack on wokeism and this attack on this elites. He did this crazy video with messianic lighting that looked like something Trump would do, where he talked about the smart elites versus the everyday people. And watching it after seeing how Trump rose to power in the U.S., it feels craven, it feels copied, and it feels like it just might work. So I agree with my colleague here. I think the average Canadian is just completely pissed off at the fact that the Trudeau government has been slow to address the housing crisis and the affordability, has been slow to counter Polyev's messaging. The whole carbon tax, axe the tax, is a bumper sticker Polyev came up with that's been highly successful. So if I were to talk to my friends and colleagues who might not be political watchers, they have an impression of Polyev as the antidote to Trudeau. Everything they hate about Canada right now and everything they're tired of from the pandemic, Polyev is the solution. They don't look a little further than that. They're not really worried about his rhetoric. They think he's just a guy making these clever attack videos and memes all day long, and they like it, right? It's a point of anger. So I think it's up to the rest of the Canadian media and the commentary and content providers to have the conversation about, well, what exactly, attacks are fine, and to a certain extent, rage farming is how it works in 2024, and pain points are good to identify in any political strategy. What are his policy solutions? Because if it's just going to be anti-immigration, xenophobic, anti-woke, this kind of stuff, we all know what that leads to. And again, I bring it back to this. We don't normally get domestic terror shootings in Canada. This isn't a thing that we see very often. To have that just happen and have a manifesto that echoes those same narratives, again, I can't put it on Polyev, but I am hoping that he'll denounce it, right? Because if he doesn't, it creates a passive permission structure that is very dangerous for our democracy. And I think it behooves all of us to stop talking about this like it's a true F. Trudeau versus Pierre Polyev or PP or all the names he has, and look at, okay, what is it saying and communicating? What permission structure is his rhetoric causing? And is he willing to put our country into that kind of chaos and jeopardy just for power? And I'm hoping that there's something more to him than someone like Trump, who's just a flat out narcissist who doesn't care.
Just on the point of talking about housing and the affordability, just being a Canadian and the fact that inflation has been sky high, and you painted a really vivid picture before, Laura, of the soup kitchens in Hamilton.
Right now, we're not just going through unprecedented period of cost of living crisis. We have families going into your stores, looking at the price of items, looking at them and putting them back because they can't afford them. We have families that are struggling to buy food for their kids in this country, in a G7 country. And they look at you and they see you making record profits. How can you justify that when families are struggling to put food on the table for their kids?
Thank you. We feel and understand that 95% of Canadians are concerned about food prices. But grocery chain profits are not the reason for food inflation. And as I mentioned...
Profit is too much profit.
Well, so a company needs some degree of profit.
Profits, more than you've ever made.
How
much profit is too much profit? You're making more money than you've ever made. How much profit is too much profit?
We're a big company and the numbers are very large.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Jagmeet Singh, during the NDP's caucus retreat in Edmonton, had this roundtable discussion actually on housing affordability. Does the fact that the NDP are really focusing on those kind of kitchen table issues, affordability, as opposed to getting into the whole kind of like memes in the way that Polyev is, does this potentially mean that in this next election, the NDP could make significant headway? Adam?
There is some opportunities for growth for the NDP in Metro Vancouver and Metro Toronto in particular. Though, unfortunately for the NDP, the Liberals' decline was low as the low 20s, 20% support, has not seen the NDP rise substantially. But they are in a place of kind of the high teens up to 20%. Which is in line or a bit above where they have been historically since the 2010s and over the time of Jagmeet Singh being the leader. But the Conservatives, the NDP often will be in battles with the Conservatives in rural Canada. Many of the potential gains that the NDP could achieve would have to be at the expense of the Conservatives in rural Canada and maybe some suburban Canada. And with the Conservatives at or near 40%, that's going to be a difficult prospect for the NDP. Furthermore, yes, these kitchen table affordability, housing issues are areas that one would think could be a benefit to the NDP. The supply management agreement that the NDP has with the Liberals to essentially prop up a minority Trudeau government is limited in language addressing this particular issue because much of the issue wasn't fully formed when the agreement was established early last year. And in fact, Polyev, to his credit, and that's one of the things I think that's leading to his popularity, is that he, in a lot of ways, forecasted both the inflation and housing crisis and affordability crises early. And he was ahead of the curve there. The NDP, not so much. The NDP have been especially aggressive on groceries and grocery chains and affordability on that front. I think the problem with housing is that, and this isn't exclusive to the NDP, the Liberals, or the Conservatives, it's just the real politic, is that it's going to take time in order to actually physically build housing units. And Canada has been, I think, had the lowest housing starts in OPEC over the last 20 years. So it's successive governments that have failed on this front to prepare for the dramatic population increases we're experiencing in 500,000 immigrants per year targets. And between July and September, we had nearly 500,000 population increase, primarily temporary workers and foreign students. And another issue is the labor force. We don't have enough skilled workers to build the homes themselves, which require to focus on those workers abroad and bring them in, which exacerbates the housing supply needs. The NDP are limited, I think, in their rhetoric to criticizing the Liberals about being flat-footed on this issue, but simultaneously they can't be too negative, because they're essentially carrying water for the Liberals by propping them up. And so they've been between a rock and a hard place there in trying to balance criticism of the Liberal Party while also justifying continuing to support them.
And Royfield, may I just pick up on something we haven't addressed yet, which I think factors in tremendously? I said, you know, that the biggest issues were affordability around inflation and food insecurity and housing. The one that I didn't mention is healthcare. We have a situation in this country where in Ontario, if you can imagine, their emergency rooms are closing. They're actually shutting down in small towns. There's 48-hour wait lists in some places to see an emergency room or doctor. We're seeing people die waiting for that care. And it is, in, I think, a fair assessment across the country, as your viewers may or may not know, or your listeners, Canada is set up with provinces and premiers who are quite powerful, not as much as governors in the U.S., but close, right? And so they negotiate these transfer payments from the Trudeau government, from the federal government for healthcare. And what we have seen is reprioritizing some of that funding away from the public system into private two-tier healthcare. In one case in Ontario, our Premier Ford is under tremendous, he's under an RCMP investigation. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police are coming after the Premier for this massive land deal scam called the Greenbelt, worth $20 billion. He got caught, and we managed to put the lands back in the Greenbelt. But what it opened up was Pandora's box of scandal. And we just found there's investigation after investigation. And one of them revealed that literally there's poaching of nursing out of our hospitals into private agencies that are reselling their services at three times the cost to the Canadian taxpayer. And it's benefiting, of course, the Ford's friends and donors in that whole sphere. So there's a ton of corruption happening just in our conservative-led province. There are other conservative premiers who are doing similar things. Alberta is a hot mess. And so I think we have to think about that in context of who will Canada put in the federal seat. There's long been a history in Ontario, the most populous and most important electoral province in the country, also the economic engine of the country, to never let there be a provincial premier who is conservative if there is a federal conservative prime minister. So I think that Ford is in trouble if Poilievre gets in. Poilievre's in trouble if Ford gets back in again, because there's a whole lot of people who might look at the health care management of these conservative premiers and say, we cannot possibly have that at both levels of government, or we're going to have people who are going to die because they can't pay the private clinics, right? So Canada is in a real moment of what is it that we value in terms of our public assets? What is it that we're willing to fight for? And I think that as much as Poilievre has been the salve for the wounds of the pandemic and for the focal point for the anger against Trudeau, some of it is very justified. I'm not sure that Canadians, when they reflect on everything at risk, are going to be willing to do that depending on the elections of these conservative premiers. So we're very much in a, I don't know about what Adam thinks, but I can't think of a time that Canada is more fraught than we are right now in terms of the direction we may go as a country and how much it might change the nature of what we've felt to be the Canadian brand for the last 30 years.
Laura, props to you in that I actually have my notes here. Alberta's pension plan proposal. So you've touched on that. You said Alberta's in a hot mess. And I also had on my notes, one of the questions was to talk about Ford and Ontario's Greenbelt controversy and allegations of favoritism. So you've done that. I'll put those two questions completely now to one side. I do want to come back to these kind of immigration targets, because immigration is one of the key things
which is keeping the frugal atmosphere of British politics alight. And I've mixed a whole load of metaphors there. But suffice to say that immigration and, let's say, I would say the unfounded fear of undocumented immigration in Britain is probably issue number one for the Conservative government. Ditto, same thing is happening in the United States. We always thought that you Canadians were much more liberal in a classic sense around immigration. And then I read that Poilievre is talking about reinstituting visas for Mexicans. So the Canadian attitude around immigration is changing.
On the streets of Toronto, where refugees are living on the pavement, it wasn't like this 8 years ago. When refugees came to Canada, we had them sponsored by charities, churches, mosques, synagogues, other nonprofits to give them homes, help them write resumes, and get them fast work permits so they could get jobs and paychecks. We see it in the new movement online of immigrants who are saying they're going back because they can't afford to live here in Canada. After 8 years of Trudeau, many immigrants feel like they're better off where they came from because the costs and the crime that Trudeau's policies have unleashed make this country unlivable for newcomers and for those who've been here a long time. I want to get back to common sense immigration. The numbers should be driven by the number of employers who have job vacancies that they cannot fill with Canadians, by the number of charities that want to sponsor refugees, and by the families that can reunite and support their loved ones here, not by egotistical targets that are designed to give Justin Trudeau a vanity project. We need to get back to competent immigration.
Can you put a little bit more flesh on those bones there for us, Adam, in terms of specifically where are new Canadians coming from? You talked about this figure of a net figure of 500,000. And then where are they coming from? And then where are they settling to in Canada? And how's that changing Canadian politics?
Yeah, I think your assessment is right that Canadians generally are more liberal about this. Illegal migrants isn't a primary concern, in part because of not just the sentiment and maybe the limitations of xenophobia or relative lack of xenophobia that you see in the United States and the UK and Europe, but also the geography, just the geographical reality of Canada itself. I, off the top of my head, most new immigrants are coming from India. The plurality would come from India. And then we have China, Nigeria, the Philippines, I would say are probably the top four or top five. And the targets of 500,000 are very ambitious. It was only announced recently by the Liberals within their new mandate that they were going to set this target. Basically, the goal is to get Canada's population somewhere near 100 million by the end of the century. We're a bit over 41 million now. Population's growing incredibly fast, and the Liberals themselves are starting to put the brakes on things, though. It's not just rhetoric from the opposition, Poilievre in particular, but the Liberals themselves are, in a way, scapegoating international students, for example. There has been pretty dramatic changes in policy around accommodating international students and reductions of 40-50%. In Ontario, I think it's going to be a 50% reduction in international students through to the end of 2025. Part of this is under the guise of clamping down on private education institutions that have the Wild West at the moment. A bunch of new ones have arisen, committing essentially fraud, promising the moon to international students, housing, jobs, in-classroom teaching, and not delivering on any of these things. But it's also in a fairly desperate attempt to try to reconcile the lack of housing supply. And that, I think, is the primary driver of concern about housing. And Poilievre himself has been suggesting that immigration be linked to housing starts, that we should not be taking in more people than we can provide houses for. His wife is a Venezuelan refugee. There's an immigrant story there. I wouldn't characterize him or the general sentiment of the Conservative Party as to be xenophobic. And I don't think that's the primary driver of concern from Canadians broadly. Canadians recognize overwhelmingly how important immigration is and are in support of it, not only like on a moral basis as a multicultural society and something that we've officially been self-identified as since the 70s, but also the economic necessity to bring in people to fill in shortages in the labor force and to counteract a aging population that's, I think the average age is mid-40s now. It's higher than the United States and China, and it's similar to a lot of Western European countries. And so in order to be able to provide much-needed services, not just labor, but funding for universal health care that is under stress, to reinvigorate the Canadian pension plan that is drawing more money out than being put in for the last 5 years or so, immigration is essential, and Canadians recognize that. But Canadians are also, I think, pragmatic and recognizing that there's something not sustainable about the current targets and the ability to accommodate everyone. And I think even the Liberals are recognizing that at this late hour.
Laura, how would Canadian politics change with a Trump victory in November? And leading on actually from immigration, specifically, how would immigration potentially be affected if your noisy neighbors down south decide to put that orange-faced populist back in power in November? Okay. Give me two or three instances of which Canadian politics would have to change or at least react to a Trump presidency.
First of all, I just want to pick up on what Adam said about the international students and his comment about the fact that Canada is not naturally xenophobic. I did a national show I do every couple of weeks, an hour debate on CTV, and I was talking about the exploitation of the foreign students, and I was disappointed that the Trudeau government, in putting that, you know, big cap on, was being a little bit performative in terms of messaging strategy. And they should have said that it's not the fault of these students, right? That our current housing woes are not. These students are sleeping three to a bed. They've been fully lied to and exploited. It's a huge black eye for Canada. And I wanted the Liberals to say clearly, don't blame the students, because I can tell you in the GTA, where the biggest population in the country is and most of our immigration settled here, people are blaming our homeless crisis. 10,000 homeless every night in Toronto, 1,600 in Hamilton. There are tents everywhere. They're blaming it on the international students now, taking the food banks, taking the low-rent apartments. It's just not true. And so I wish that the Trudeau government had been explicit about that, because what's happening is, as I was doing the show live, my phone was blowing up from across the country with people telling me that it's the fault of the students, that the immigration is the problem, that everything is to blame. And I hadn't seen that level of xenophobia and anger in Canada before. I think that it's a very important issue. It's like the third rail now of Canadian politics and how people are going to handle that. So when you ask me about Trump, Trump is not an orange-faced populist. He's a fascist. He is a Hitler-quoting, Mussolini-quoting fascist, and he wants to take over the democracy that was America, the Republic, and turn it into a fascist authoritarian regime. He has said so. And more importantly than his rhetoric, which we can often scoff at, I never have, because I come from a fundamentalist religious background where I had to go to big tent meetings as a child with a minister father. And when I saw Trump's rallies in 2015, I rang the alarm bell that this stuff has a certain momentum to it. And so watching him now and him saying explicitly, I'm going to be a dictator on day one, going to round up millions of immigrants and kick them out of the country, going to put them in camps. They are the poison of the blood. I just ripped this stuff out of Mein Kampf, and let's not pretend that it's anything other than that. What's important, though, is for people who say, yeah, that's just Trump, that's just his BS, he just wants to stay out of jail. He has had a very intelligent and deep and sophisticated and widespread machine behind him the last 2 years that has been organizing how to, in fact, bring in all loyalists, how to take apart the justice system. There are clever people who missed their opportunity when he won in 2016, who have spent their time figuring out how to do it fast when they get back in. So if Trump wins in the US, I think that for a lot of Canadians who have a very low opinion of Trump, other than there were some Trump signs in some rural parts of Canada, it's terrifying. So what will that mean for us? I imagine we're going to have, we had draft dodgers back in the day come to Canada. I can imagine maybe there'll be a mass attempt at migration to Canada to get away from a fascist regime in the States. Sounds crazy to say it, but we're 10 months away from finding out what that might look like, right? What a new world order might in fact look like, at least for Western democracies. We're that close. And so I think that this, it's like a tidal wave that's going to hit our country in terms of fear, in terms of all of our family who live there, in terms of the immigration. Who are they going to round up? How are they going to round up? What does that look like? And what does it look like for us as the neighbor with the largest undefended border in the world? Like, there's no way I'm not being hyperbolic. If he wins and he does what he says, and the people who have been working on ways to do purity tests for the civil service and everything else we've heard about, if all of that happens, it's going to be massive for Canada. So is it going to make us more compassionate and little L liberal? Is it going to make us more afraid? And where fear grows, so does violence and anger and hate. Is it going to make us also line up with Trump out of fear? It depends who's running our country, right? So this is why I said off the top of the show, Canadian politics is like amateur baseball compared to the US, right? We're not the major leagues. And the NDP are essentially feckless under Jugmeet. They put forward great values and they push Trudeau to implement their policies. And that's great. They're the party of conscience, but they don't really have a chance. It's really going to be about how much do Canadians observe what's happening in the US. If Biden were to win and Trump goes to jail, Canadians might say, hey, let's have Poilievre. It can't be that bad. There's no real threat happening. But I just don't think Canadians will be too cool with the idea of Trump down there and a conservative government up here that might not be far right in Poilievre's heart. He might just be a populist and he might just be piffle. But his supporters on the right wing extreme certainly get a lot of wind in their sails. And we've seen a huge rise in hate across this country in the last year. And we are seeing tremendous online attacks. Every time I mention Poilievre's name, I'm subjected to about 100 attacks an hour. This stuff is meant to silence and intimidate. And fascists count on people believing that they are both inevitable and invincible. And we have to fight back against that. Sorry for the long answer, Royfield, but it is at the level where anyone watching what's happening in the U.S. knows that there's always been this thing. Canada is a mouse in the bed with the elephant. If the U.S. rolls over into fascism, we're the F word. I don't want to swear on your podcast, right? We'll be screwed, because how do you possibly remain democratic and a bulwark against that kind of chaos and madness? It's often been likened that Canada is like living above a meth lab since Trump got in. And if he wins in the fall and goes for broke and finally has the machinery behind him to do what he wants and to pursue his enemies list and everything else, the meth lab will explode. So
I think
that's where we're
looking. I think Trudeau announced a Team Canada initiative this week as part of the caucus retreat, basically forecasting some anticipation for Trump winning in November. And I think the bookies are certainly saying that it's looking likely. I'm very bullish on Trump winning. And Trudeau is getting ahead of the game here, I think. And it's actually one of the first times I've seen him be proactive in a long time. I think it was a smart move. And I think it's part of a rollout of trying to align Poilievre with Trump as Trump ascends to the White House again. But also, there were some very practical aspects to the Team Canada approach will be renegotiated in 2026. And it's emulating a rather successful approach to deal with Trump in his first term, led by Chrystia Freeland, the now Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance. She won't be leading the charge this time. There are some other liberal heavyweights to do this work. But I think that it is an issue for Poilievre. I think if this sort of associated Trump label, as Trump adjacent label, starts to stick a bit, it could help to curb some of those undecided, wavering voters, in particular in Ontario, but in kind of the metro regions around the country, suburban regions around the country, who aren't fixed to any one party and decide between the Conservatives and the Liberals from time to time. This might be enough to convince some of them to stick with the Liberals. And to that point, the Agnes Reid poll, just to show how desperate the situation is for Trudeau and the Liberals right now, they got 24% in the poll, but only 9% of that 24% said they are voting for Trudeau and the Liberals regardless, because they support Trudeau and the Liberals. The other 15% said they're supporting the Liberals to keep the Conservatives out. So really, we're looking at arguably single-digit popular support for Trudeau and the Liberals at the moment. And I think it might be too far gone for them to recover from this. I think the best they can hope for is to keep the Conservatives to a minority status, because in that case scenario, it's unlikely that the other political parties are willing to play game with the Conservatives. The Conservatives won't have confidence. And a 1980 situation with Joe Clark and Pierre Trudeau, where, you know, the Conservative minority government lasts months rather than years. But I think that this is all very optimistic. I think it's very unlikely the Conservatives are, I think even with the label of Trump adjacent, which I don't think will stick, but even if that does work to a degree, I still think the Conservatives are just so far ahead at this point that a majority government is inevitable. And some Canadians may actually look at it as saying, hey, if Trump's going to be in there for the next 4 years, and we've already dealt with Trump once for 4 years, maybe we can do it again, but this time we have someone that Trump can, they can make a deal, that the perception is that Justin Trudeau is not liked by Trump and is, I think, perceived by many Canadians as a lightweight internationally. Anyways, he's been embarrassed at many of these international summits that can work with this guy, because there's a relationship yet to be established.
And it's really, that would be more aligned. And I think, if I can, like, Canada is not at, we are at risk of white right-wing extremism. We just saw the shooting at the City Hall yesterday. We are at risk of xenophobia and hate and all kinds of other things. It's getting scary here. But we're not at risk, I don't think, of losing our democratic institutions overnight. There hasn't been the work like there has been in the U.S., and Trump's got a six-year lead on this stuff. So I don't think Canadians are looking at it like, Poilievre gets in, it's going to be existential threat to Canadian democracy. Yeah. But I do think if Trump is in and Poilievre is in, for Canadians, it might be a bifurcated thing of, do you appease the big monster to the south and work with him and we'll get along better if we get along with Trump, which is a strategy. Fascists count on that. Or is it going to be, we have to protect our values at all costs, because there is always a south-north creep of ideology and of popular culture from the U.S. We're usually 10 years behind them. And so Canadians might say it's just too big of a risk. Poilievre's untested. He'll probably kowtow to Trump. It might protect us a little bit, but Trump is, as we know, he's mercurial. So if Poilievre does one thing that pisses him off, then that whole value proposition might go out the window anyway. So I just think that right now it's going to be whether or not Trudeau is putting more money in people's pockets, whether or not we're seeing less people in homelessness on the streets, whether or not the grocery prices go down, and whether or not that label is actually Maple MAGA is what it's called. And I think that people are, we're going to have 10 months of inundated with Trump bloviating from his court cases. We are going to be overwhelmed by Trump TV for the next 10 months in this country. And I don't think that is going to do anything other than irritate a lot of Canadians, because I think that Trump's popularity in this country, unless it's changed, I haven't checked, is pretty low. So that might actually play against the Conservatives up here. We'll have to see.
Just before we wrap this up, I've got to say two things. I don't think I've ever done a Mid-Atlantic where I've spoken as little as this. The pair of you just gone backwards and forwards. So we're going to have to do this again. We're going to have to do this as a bit of a regular thing, because my goodness, I think I've maybe said four things and the pair of you have just run and run. But if the Liberals are doing so badly, and you've painted this picture, Adam, saying that you can actually look at the Liberals of having single digits in terms of their true support. There are people saying they'll vote for them because they don't like the alternatives. Should Trudeau face an internal challenge? Should the Liberals get rid of him? Tell us about Freeland, Jolly and Carney and anybody else who potentially could revitalise the Liberal Party before the election. You start, Adam, then Laura, you pick up.
Yeah, I think that ship has sailed. It's too late. There were some rumblings of discontent among some of the caucus members at the caucus retreat this week. Some have rolled back their suggestion of a leadership contest today. So it does seem like, again, Trudeau at these caucus retreats has been successful in bringing the team together and backing him. But it was starting to peek through, and Canadian politics is especially sensitive to criticism of leadership within parties, unlike the UK, which has a proud tradition of overt backstabbing and public expressions of discontent of the backbenchers, including votes in the House of Commons. In Canada, the whip is extremely strong. I would say it's the strongest of any British parliamentary system. And so the culture is basically follow the leader or else. And people are expelled. Members of parliament have been expelled for very, little.
I'm completely and utterly an observer to Canadian politics. Explain to me, if the whip is that strong and following the leader is seen as a cultural norm, explain to me all these revolving doors of conservative leaders then.
Based on election performance, right? And so it's the inability to break through Trudeau's hold on power, maybe reducing him to a minority status, but not being able to achieve a minority or majority status themselves. And also those leaders previous to Poilievre were in nail-biter leadership contests in which the margins of victory were in this, a percentage or two in the case of O'Toole. That wasn't the case with Poilievre. So that's why there's been a bit of a rotation. But as for the prospects of I think if the Liberals had got rid of Trudeau last fall, that would have been the window, because the next general election is slated for October 2025. Of course, it could be any day now if the NDP choose to pull the plug. But assuming we go out to 2025, end of 2025, the window of opportunity to get a new leader would have been late last year, with a leadership contest probably before Christmas, and an opportunity for the new leader to come in this spring, new throne speech, new budget, and establish a year and a half window to establish their brand and their own mandate separate from Trudeau. Those that are prospective leadership candidates would be Freeland and Carney. I think those are the clear two. Name recognition amongst Canadian ministers is an all-time low. Most Canadians can't name more than two ministers. Actually, I'm not even sure most Canadians can name more than one, which is unusual. Usually, cabinet ministers are known. And for some reason, in Trudeau's government, this isn't the case. But Freeland has the highest name recognition. The issue, though, is that she is aligned, like all the other cabinet ministers and leadership prospects who are elected members of parliament. They are all attached at the hip to Trudeau, and so they are not distinct from him. And that's the advantage that Mark Carney would have. The former Bank of Canada head, former Goldman Sachs alumni, former Bank of England head during the 2008 financial crisis and afterwards, with a lot of international credit, who has not been a politician, who has a new book that came out last year, has been promoting this consumer price index, and has softly dipped his toe to check the temperature and waded into maybe some soft criticism of the Trudeau government. He would be, I think, the best prospect, especially with the turbulent economic situation that we're in and stagnant GDP growth, declining GDP per capita, affordability, all of these sort of things. But I think the window has closed now. There isn't enough time for someone else to come in and put fresh paint on the brand.
Laura?
Yeah, Mark Carney did a speech, actually, I think at an economic club, I forget where it was, a few months ago, that sounded like a prime minister in waiting. It was a vision for Canada. It was brilliant. I listened to it five times and thought, oh man, wouldn't have that been nice, right? because he's not associated with the Emergencies Act against the convoy. He's not associated with the carbon tax, the two most, I think, animating issues for the right in this country. And what I do think is interesting is that Freeland is like Trudeau. They are attached at the hip. She has been the biggest speaker. The only other ministers that even come across the radar are Champagne, who's been doing some stuff around the grocery stuff, and Sean Fraser, who's the housing minister, who's actually getting out there and doing Poilievre-style videos and much more accessible and a lot more announcements. And you feel like maybe this guy gets it. But short of that, there's really nothing. And that's part of the criticism of the Trudeau government, is they put so much stock into Trudeau's personal appeal and brand. And as long as he was the Sunny Ways guy and whipping things up and carrying that family Canadian brand, it was all good. But as soon as he started to take vacations, that became suspect, and stopped showing up and talking about stuff and went through his own personal crisis, he became, I think, a little bit enfeebled. And instead of the bench stepping up and saying, oh, we got this, they kept just figuring that Trudeau was so loved that he'd figure it out, and he hasn't. And now the bench doesn't seem strong, and people don't know them and trust them, which is why Carney would have been, I think, their best alternative. Now that we're stuck with the Trudeau thing, one thing that I think is under-assessed is that in my neighborhood, I have to watch pickup trucks drive by every day with F. Trudeau flags, right? And MAGA flags, right? This is a thing in Canada after the convoy occupation. I think for Canadians, at least older voters, still, F. Trudeau really bothers them. They might not be happy with Justin. They might not be happy with his immigration targets and the lack of housing and their food prices, but they hate that. They hate seeing such obnoxious, rude stuff. And I think if it was F. Justin, it would be one thing. But this F. Trudeau thing that we see in our face all the time, even if you don't like Trudeau and you're sick of what's happening in the economy, that's not cool. That's gross. That's why I'm saying this Maple MAGA thing isn't for the Trudeau government to slap on Polyev. It's Canadians who see it every time we pull into a gas station, right? So sometimes people go too far in these attack campaigns, right, where it actually blows back and people are like, no, you know what? Not listening to that, seeing that I'm not empowering that because that's just gross. Whether I'm sick of Trudeau and his cabinet and their ivory tower politics, I'm still not happy with a Canada that is going to walk and drive around with an F somebody everywhere I go. It'll be interesting to see if they're able to put real solutions on the table. If I was in the meeting in Montreal right now with Trudeau's cabinet, they've got a new comms guy in there who's supposed to be making this all work better for them. I don't know why they haven't been out with 50 different videos about what's happening behind those doors and about the changes they're going to make. And they're still operating like it's 2010 or 1978. They're still not getting the juggernaut of comms and the social media juggernaut that is TikTok in this country. And that Pierre Poilievre, I've got teenagers. They know everything that Poilievre's up to because he's constantly telling them. And Trudeau and them are still sitting in this fancy hotel in Montreal thinking that if they're just having panel discussions around affordability, like that enough. That was lame in 2020 or 2010. But in 2024, up against the kind of campaign that we're seeing out of a populist leader, they're nowhere near it. And so I really think the Emergencies Act, how that comes down, may be what really galvanizes that single digit support of Trudeau higher, where people are like, no, he's my guy. I'm loyal to him because he did the right thing in that crisis in this country, like his dad did with the invoking of the Emergencies Act. So I think that builds to Trudeau's brand. And I think that what happens with Trump and this idea of watching more pickup trucks and MAGA flags is not something that any of us want to deal with more than we already are. And that might also get people who are soft liberal supporters or people like me. I'm independent. I think I've voted for every party in a different way, depending on the leadership in the last 25 years. I might look at that and say, if the decision is bifurcated between MAGA North, Maple MAGA, and or just trying to get our economy back and pushing Trudeau and his minority to do better, that might be what happens. But I think probably at the end of the day, at this point, it would be a conservative minority, depending on the Trump factor and the Emergencies Act Supreme Court ruling, could be a conservative. If it was today, it would be a conservative majority. But give it more time and more Trump television and more of this stuff and more, God forbid, political violence that we're starting to see at rallies, I don't think Canadians have the appetite for it.
Yeah, I agree with the not having the appetite. But Laura, I think you touched on an interesting point and kind of a demographic event that is inverted to the tradition. It's 65 plus voters, age 65 plus voters that are most likely to be supporting the Liberals. And actually, the Conservatives are winning 18 to 29, 30 to 45. And the 30 to 45 in particular is their largest support base, in part because of the savviness of social media. Pierre Poilievre is a good 8 years younger than Justin Trudeau. We always think of Justin Trudeau as a young guy, but he's actually, Poilievre is substantially.
Same age as Trudeau. Watch out what you're going to say now.
And I think that even if, when you looked at the polls of, say, the convoy at the time, it's a generational gap. Older Canadians were appalled and overwhelmingly were against this. But younger Canadians, not just a plurality, I think a clear majority of younger Canadians polled were, quote unquote, sympathetic to the truckers. And I think that there is a sentiment that isn't exclusive to white redneck conservatives who just want to polish their guns and drink stronger beer than they got down south. A lot of young people, I think, feel burned by the experience of the pandemic and the government's the mandates and the lockdowns. I think there was a hearing Neil Young lecture 20-year-olds about being super spreaders when his seminal years and his big come up was during the Hong Kong flu. Woodstock was a super spreader event. Neil Young didn't have a problem then. And I think that generational divide is there.
Imagine your life being cut off at 20, right? For 3 years?
Laura.
Yeah.
Laura.
Exactly.
Adam, we're going to do this again. This has been phenomenal, but I'm going to have a mountain to edit here and I need to get the show out.
Right.
So it's still relevant. So I'm so sorry, Laura. I had to cut you there. Laura Babcock from Hamilton. Tell people where they can catch up with you on the socials.
Twitter. My name is Laura Babcock on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. Mostly Twitter, though, for political commentary. That's where I play all day.
Or and next. Adam, same question to you, sir.
I'm a Luddite. I'm intending to ramp up a YouTube channel to do Canadian political commentary. But right now you can find me on Clubhouse, Adam K.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a show on YouTube, which is provincial and is going to probably be national by next year, and that is The O Show on YouTube. Sorry, I forgot YouTube.
But you know, I don't think we can forget you, Pet. And also, special shout out goes out to Elizabeth Astrom, who impeached me. She implored me, that's a better word, she implored me to do a show on Canadian politics. And there you go. All right, and we're going to have these pair on again. Don't forget, folks, super simple, leftist end of politics is right thinking politics. I'm Royfield Brown. You can email me at royfield@gmail.com and I'll open your emails. I'll read it and you never know, I might even respond. There you go, folks. Take care. Look after yourselves. But that was brilliant. You pair, match made in heaven.